Hello, I'd like to welcome everyone to another author event at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I'm John Charles, and tonight the Poison Pen is honored to have with us author Amy K. Runyon, whose new book is A Bakery in Paris. If you're joining us virtually, I'd like to let you know you can order copies of Amy's books through our web store or by giving us a call. We'd be happy to put one in the mail or hold one for you at the Poison Pen. Now I'd like to welcome Amy K. Runyon.
Thank you all so very much, and thank you, John Charles, for having me. This is such a lovely venue, such a fun bookstore, and a lovely crowd coming out.
We're delighted you could be with us. My first question for you is, I am always fascinated by authors because they have a story before they became a writer.
True.
So what can you tell us about Amy before you became published, even though, if I remember correctly, you got the inkling to write back in the third grade?
That is correct. I started, honestly, the most dangerous thing that ever happened to me was when in third grade, Mrs. Seed, my third grade teacher, let us all write our first short story. And we all got these little books. Mine was leopard print that one of the classroom grandmothers had bound all by herself. And each kid got to pick their own. And I just thought it was amazing. And I got to write this really cheesy retelling of the legend of Atalanta and the foot race. And I turned it into a horse race. And, I just thought it was amazing and so much fun. And I think that the die was cast when they later cast me as Scribbler Mouse in the school play. So Mrs. Seed was really, kind of the integral part to that. And she came to my book event up in my hometown just a few days ago and gifted me a third grade classroom picture. So I got to make her blush quite a bit during that presentation, because that was the first time I really, I was like, 8 years old, becoming a bit more aware of, that I was going to have to earn a living someday. And, I didn't have to, count beans for a living. I could do something really, really cool, like write a book. And I think that stuck with me for a long time, and I fell in love with reading. Yeah, that's where it started. But I never really gave myself permission to invest the time in writing a book, because, of course, a work of about 100,000 words, that's a lot of time, isn't it? It is a lot of time to invest in writing. And I knew that everybody had told me how hard it was to make a living at writing books, and I can affirm it is. It very much is. And so I never gave myself permission to do it. I majored in something more practical. For some reason, I thought that would be French literature. And I ended up teaching French for a long time, and I loved it. But I do echo J.K. Rowling's sentiments on her website when she thanked her agent for ensuring she'll never have to teach how to conjugate an irregular French verb ever again for the rest of her life. And yeah, I definitely empathize with that. But, I took a couple of short creative writing classes when I was in graduate school. And I wrote a short story that would become kind of the genesis for Promise to the Crown, my debut novel. And it sat in a drawer for 10 years with all the notes from all my classmates. And I picked it up and dropped it and picked it up and dropped it. But, I got married. I started a career teaching. I had a couple of kids, and it was hard. And again, it was a huge investment of time. But, I was teaching online when my kids were really tiny, before it was even cool. And, I would save a couple hours in the afternoon when they were napping, when all my teaching was done, all my momming stuff was done before I had to start dinner. And while they were napping, I would take a bath and read a book. And I loved it. It was like the highlight of my day. And one day I read a book that made me so, it was just not very good. And this person had won some awards, and I'm just, I could do better than that. And I shook myself. I'm 33. It's time to do something for me. I've been, spending the last, year and a half on full-time mom duty and teaching at the same time. I'm going to take 2 hours every day and finish that darn book. Just so even if the only person who ever reads it is my mother, that's fine. I'm going to write the book. And after 6 months, I had a draft of a book, and it was terrible, and I made it less terrible, and I went to some writing conferences, and the rest is history. And that book became Promise to the Crown.
Wow. Yeah. That brings us to your book today that you're going to talk to us about, A Bakery in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
You've described it as Les Miserables meets Chocolat.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Okay, so those books may seem completely unrelated, but I promise you there are some similarities. It's Les Miserables in that we're dealing with class struggles. And, you know, we talk about the French Revolution ad nauseum as how it was, you know, the great liberation for the common man of France, and France being a society that is very conscious about not, you know, about having a very egalitarian society. You know, they don't have fancy graduation ceremonies. They just don't. It's just not what's done. But the French Revolution was only the first step in that process. They had a monarchy again 12 years later, right? It was a symbolic victory, and they had a lot of uprisings and things put down, one of those being depicted in Les Misérables. It was like in 1848 in one of the uprisings. And this has to do with one of the last big uprisings, which was the Paris Commune, where the people of Paris said, "Hey, Emperor, you stink. We're going to do it ourselves." And they took a go. They had a go at governing themselves for about 2 months before they were set down. But the difference there was that they never had a monarchy again, because the reprisal against the communards was so violent and so terrible. They murdered 25,000 Parisians for daring to want to govern themselves or even being suspected of collusion. And even the people who had been sympathetic with the Versailles, the other side, thought they'd gone way overboard. And so there was never support for a monarchy ever again. And so it was, you know, definitely an important pivotal part in French history. So that's the Les Mis side. Chocolat is that I brought in the importance of French baking throughout the entire thing to connect the two timelines. And, you know, just the sumptuous nature of French food and cooking, partially as a contrast to the dire situation that people during the Commune were living under, and especially just prior to the Commune during the siege of Paris, as well as the post-World War II timeline. But how bread was such an integral part of the French diet. We can't overstate how important bread was in the 19th century, especially French diet and prior. People would eat a pound of the stuff every day with whatever soup they could put together, with whatever ingredients they had on hand. But bread was always the staple. And so the bakery was the center of Parisian life. And so getting into the sumptuousness of the food was, you know, how I made the contrast between those two.
And the book is a dual timeline story.
Indeed.
1870s, 1946.
Yep.
You've got two protagonists, Lisette and Micheline.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about them.
Okay, so Lisette is, she's our heroine in 1870, and she's a girl from Mines. She lives in the Place des Vosges, which is a very chic part of Paris where Victor Hugo used to live, if that gives you an indication of how cool it was. And it's beautiful. It's still there. I got to take some pictures with the book in front of the Place des Vosges, which was great fun. Sorry, I knocked the table. And she comes from riches, but when she encounters a young man from the National Guard that was sympathetic to the common man rising up to govern themselves, she has her beliefs challenged because she has never fit in with her family. And she realizes that the foundation of her life has perhaps not been the most authentic, the most ethical way to look at life, and that the common person has a right to some autonomy and self-governance. And makes the decision to forsake a life of comfort for a life founded by her ideals. And that comes with it a great price. And then we have Micheline, who is a young woman. She's 19 years old when the story begins in 1946. Her father died early days in the war, not spoiling too much. That comes out like on the first page of her chapter, sorry. And her mother had gone missing toward the end of the war. And so here she is at the age of 19, left raising her 8 and 12-year-old sisters, Sylvie and Noémie. For better or for worse, and it is a hard go because it seems like any advantage she has, any resource she has, keeps getting scaled back more and more. And it's really a discussion of her finding her own agency throughout her life and doing the best she can with limited means and finding her path the same way that her great-grandmother did through the doors of a little green bakery in Montmartre.
If I understand correctly, originally there were three timelines in this book, but something happened.
Yes. Oh, dear Veronica. She's a great character. I loved her. She was going to be set in the 1990s, and she was going to come back, and her grandmother would have run the bakery for a number of years, but shuttered it when her husband died. And she was going to go back after, you know, a tragedy befell her, and she was going to bring everything back to life. And she never got off the ground. I tried and tried and tried, and she just was not meant for this book. I like her as a character. I'm going to do something with her down the road. But she was not meant for this book. And, you know, I did something different with this book that I have not done in other books where I'd had multiple POVs or multiple timelines, in that instead of writing sequentially, after I got the first 4-6 chapters done or so, I actually wrote all of Lisette's timeline. And then I wrote all of Micheline's timeline. And by the time I finished Lisette's timeline, I had 50,000 words. And by the time I had Micheline's done, I was at 30,000 words, and I felt like I could have kept going. And it's like, oh, I am running out of space, and this cannot be a 200,000-word magnum opus, or my editor it'll be cheaper for my editor to fly out from New York and murder me here in Colorado than for her to edit this book. And so I emailed my lovely editor, Tessa Woodward at William Morrow, and I said, hey, Tessa, how attached are you to that third timeline that I put in the proposal? And she said, do what you got to do. It's fine. And so I love that she trusted me. And so I lopped off poor Veronica, who will make an appearance in a later book, I hope. And some of the vibe, and there was a scene where she was standing in the middle of the bakery that was in absolute ruin, or her grandmother's apartment upstairs, actually, and deciding, what in the heck do I do? Where do I start? And I actually take that and put it in the like basically one of the chapters of my upcoming contemporary novel. I took that vibe and moved it to another story, which was good because you get those little darlings and it's nice to be able to reuse them even after you murder them. You can revive them and bring them back. And I just decided to beef up Micheline's timeline and then intersperse the recipes a little bit more than I'd originally planned to do, because I had the space then to be able to do it. And to do both timelines more justice. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about research when you're writing historical fiction, because you have to balance all that you learn with telling a story. And how do you find that line between incorporating historical facts and wanting to tell a good story? Do you always know? Do you leave stuff out? What's your process?
Oh, you have to leave things out. And, you know, I liken it like this. I always use cooking metaphors, if you can't tell. It's like, you know, if you're eating a dish, garlic is a lovely flavor, but you don't want an entire clove of it in one bite most of the time, right? So, it's a question of mixing in the historical details finely enough and mincing them finely enough and stirring them in deftly enough that it's palatable, because the story always has to be paramount. If you want to read a history book about the Paris Commune, read John Merriman's Massacre. Brilliant book. You'll love it. In fact, do read that. Do absolutely. If you like that timeline, do read that book. But if you want to read a story about the human emotions, about what people were going through in the Paris Commune and post-World War II, this is where you come for that. And so the story and the characters always were paramount. And of course, the world was, international travel wasn't open when I was doing a lot of the research. So I couldn't do any real archival research for this book. But I think it was okay. I started out with that particular book, John Merriman's Massacre, and I data mined I read that for the sequence of events and a lot of the meat of what was happening and of what was going on in the Paris Commune, and some of them in English, some of them in the native French, and from various points of view. Usually not from the working man's point of view because they're busy trying to survive, but a lot of the aristocracy or visiting diplomats from England and the U.S., had very interesting things to say. And so that was where I got a lot of the research for that. And of course, then in the 1946 timeline, we're dealing with post-war. And so we're not dealing with the nitty-gritty of the war and needing to know when X battle happened, Y battle happened. It was a human story. And so we're not dealing with a lot of, the real structure of various battles. The research there is centered around, like, the Red Cross and the efforts they did to help reunite people with missing family members. And so it was a slightly different process for that one.
While you were doing your research, what did you discover for this book that surprised you the most?
One of the most interesting books I read was called Good Bread is Back. And I'm sorry, I don't remember the author, but it's the history of French bread. It's like, yes, sign me up, please. That sounds amazing. And it was about how in post-World War II, the quality of French bread started to decline, and how in the 1980s and 90s, they decided that that wasn't going to fly anymore. And they were because the French care so passionately about food. That they weren't going to let those standards slide anymore, and that to be called artisanal French bread, they had to meet certain standards, and it had to be made on site. And they didn't want it to become, you know, yeah, you can get a passable loaf of bread at Leclerc or whatever supermarket you go to, but they wanted, you know, the bakeries that are getting federal subsidies and things like that to make bread affordable. They had to follow certain standards so that that treasure of French cuisine isn't lost. And it's a time-taking it's, you know, it's very simple. It's flour, water, you know, yeast, and very simple salt, a little bit of sugar, perhaps. It's a very simple recipe, but to do it right is very painstaking. And so they are really taking the quality back. I thought that was amazing.
One of the things I love as a reader is when you learn these little facts, and I want to know if this is true or not, but in the book, during the siege, the women of Paris stand in front of the cannons to keep them from being taken. Was that true?
Oh, absolutely true. That was one of those things where I was, that was the one, you know, the element when I was reading, you know, the secondary source material and everything, I'm like, that's the scene. That's the pivotal scene in the book. That was one of the first scenes I envisioned writing before I even, you know, took pen, you know, took fingers to keyboard. I say pen to paper, but fingers to keyboard, in order to bring that book to life. The women were the ones that defended the cannons from the Versaillais, and it really happened. But the funny part was that the Versaillais troops, the brass, the generals, forgot the horses to lure the cannons down. And bear in mind, the people of Montmartre paid for the cannons themselves. These were cannons they purchased to protect Paris from the Prussian army. And the Versaillais didn't like that they had them after the war was lost. And they didn't want to have the people armed against the, you know, against the troops. And so they take the entire, you know, a good chunk of the Versaillais army up to Montmartre, prepared to take the cannons, and they forgot the horses. Because, you know, it's a very efficient organization, and they left the, you know, they left the grunts up there, the recruits, and these are farm boys, and these are factory workers, and they left them with the women. The women fed them. And they said, you don't want to listen to the generals. What do they know about a nice farm boy like you? Who's feeding you? Did they even give you breakfast? I don't think they did. No, no. And they, you know, they said, you've got way more in common with us than those idiots wearing, you know, the big funny hats and the brass on their on their lapels, right? So when the brass came back with the horses, they refused to fire on the women. General Thiers was yelling at these men to fire, to open fire on the women who were guarding the cannons, and they refused to do it. And that's how the Paris Commune was born. And so I knew immediately it had to be set in Montmartre, and that my Louisette had to be there defending the cannons.
One of the other things that I think you may have had to research is recipes and cooking and baking back in the 1940s, because when you look at the recipes, they're not what we're used to today.
Not at all,
no. What was involved in that?
Okay, so what I did was I found this wonderful transcription of the original Antoine Carême recipes. And he's the grand, for those of you who don't know the name, he's the grandfather of all French pastry baking. He is like, for us in America, you know, the grandmother of all good American cooking, Julia Child, right? We can't top her. And before her, it was Jacques Pépin. Before him, it was Escoffier. Before him, Carême. And he was really the person that really started formalizing recipes in a real serious way. I mean, we've got recipe books. I found recipe books dating back to the 1600s. But he was the one that started really formalizing things, and he created schools. And so I found this wonderful transcription of his recipes. And so I played with them because, well, of course, I mean, I don't think they're copyrighted, but I took them and I made them more readable. I shortened them because some of them were rather long, and I added in Lisette's, usually Lisette, sometimes Micheline's notes, and made them something that was more interesting to read. But of course, these are not recipes that you should follow at home, because it says put 6 pounds of flour and then you put it in a hot oven. So first of all, what the heck is a hot oven? 450 degrees, just FYI. But, you know, they're also like industrial size recipes. Often if you want to make a dozen loaves of French bread, have at it, but it's a lot. And so what I'm doing, because I know a lot of people who read this book are obviously going to be bakers. A lot of you, I bet, enjoy baking. Maybe not when it's 110 degrees outside, but you enjoy baking maybe in the winter. And so what I'm doing every week on my socials and on my blog is I'm doing a little teaser video of one of the recipes from the book or a personal favorite recipe, because I can, I'm sassy. And I start off with my dark chocolate cheesecake, which is neither French nor in the book, but it's my favorite recipe. It was my wedding cake. The book is dedicated to my husband, and it was our wedding cake. And so I did that for our first recipe. And then I'll do just a little teaser video on socials, because I don't have a production crew in my house, very sadly, to do a real baking video. But then I send you to my blog for the full instructions. So, and the second week we did French sablé, and I have recipes for you. You can have recipes to take with you. And I have, this week was the rose petal jam, which was one of my favorite recipes from the book. So.
That's great. Let's talk a little bit about, there's a kind of thematic color to the book, green.
Green.
How did that come up, and what does it mean to the story?
It's rebirth and renewal, because we have Paris in two of these great periods. You know, the Paris Commune, where it's rising up after a lapse into monarchy and trying to decide what it becomes. And it launches right into the Belle Époque, the beautiful period in Paris, which will be the topic of my next book, historical book, which is fun. And so the 1880s and 1890s were a glorious period in Paris. And it was, if it hadn't been for this, that wouldn't have happened. And so that period of renewal, and of course, post-World War II is a period of great renewal. And I was really excited to write about the post-war period because, you know, we have so many books, and I've written a few of them myself, where, you know, it's World War II and people, you've got a plucky heroine who's often a French female spy. They're doing cool things. The war is over. The Nazis go home and we all live happily ever after. But that wasn't the case. I mean, you can't live through a war like World War II in, you know, the city where that was affected the most, Paris, and leave the war unscathed. And, you know, I'm a staunch pacifist, and I wanted to show the price that was paid, even by the victors, for this war. And so that's, you know, the rebirth after the war, but it was very painful. And then on a personal level, because my husband inspired this book when we were first dating and everything, this is the color of his birthstone. And so the green is a little nod to him as well.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about A Bakery in Paris. Is not the only book you've written this year. You have another one called The Castle Keepers.
Yes.
Which is multiple timelines, but you weren't responsible for all of them.
No, I got to do the 1870 timeline because, you know, I'm on a brand. No, it's because I love writing the late night friends, Rachel McMillan and Janelle Sosalski, who are lovely authors. One of them is in Toronto. The other one is in the DC area. And this was her kind of lockdown baby that we found out that, you know, Harper Muse was looking for collaborations. They thought it was a great thing happening in historical fiction. And so it was kind of the beautiful project that got us through the darkest days of the stay-at-home orders and homeschooling my children at home by myself. And so we collaborated every single day for the longest time on that project. And so my period is 1870, and it's to do with a woman, Beatrice Holbrook, who is a dollar princess from the United States. And she has a rather embarrassing encounter in Caroline Astor's dining room, and realizes she will never gain entree into great New York society. So the only place where it might have been easier for her to go up the social ladder was Victoria's England, believe it or not. And so she went off in search of a title, and she finds herself married to a man who is in line for a marquisate, and in a very fateful place called Leedswick Castle. And then the other two timelines, written by Janelle and Rachel respectively, follow the same family in the same castle in the period around World War I and World War II. And it's, over three different conflicts, with the original character, Charles Alnwick, is somebody who's basically suffering PTSD after his encounters in the conflict in India that he served in 5 years before the start of the war. And then we're dealing with the aftermath of World War I and World War II, are the repercussions from that. Same family, same castle. And it was a lot of fun to write. And we're doing another collaboration together called The Liberty Scarf that will follow three women in World War I and a scarf from the famed Liberty of London shop. Yeah.
What was it like writing with other people? And remember, they could be watching this
oh,
as you're speaking.
It was a joy. Honestly, it was a joy. Because, you know, and I've heard horror stories about collaborations, but Rachel and Janelle and I, between the three of us, have exactly zero ego. And so, you know, we defer a lot to each other and we respect each other. And we have writing styles that are not necessarily all that similar, but that can complement each other. And we have similar ideas about what we enjoy writing. And so it was absolutely a joy. And so our stories were very separate in that one, but we're going to work on braiding them together more in this next one so that it reads more like a traditional novel. And that will be a fun experiment to see how that goes. But they're lovely to work with, lovely to work with.
That's great. My next question for you is, why historical fiction? Why do you want to write about the past?
Well, and this is for any of you who are aspiring authors, either in the audience or who are listening at home. I went into it for the best of all reasons. It's what I gravitated to as a reader. I remember when I was, you know, probably middle school, Sweet Valley High came out with this historical saga of all the grandmothers, like great-great-grandmother of the twins from the books. And going forward generation by generation, and I read the cover off that book, and I loved it because it was set back. Didn't have a lot of, you know, my sisters read the other books, and they were fine, but I loved the historical ones. And then I remember when I was in college, I finally had a chance to read a book for fun for the first time in, you know, a year, probably, as one does during college, you're reading everything that's assigned. I got a gift card to a local independent bookstore up in Oregon, and I asked my uncle what I should buy, and he was a very avid reader, and he said, well, if you like historical stuff, read Pillars of the Earth by Ken Follett, and man, that is just, that book will suck you in, and it was a tapestry of a book, and it was just one of those books that embroidered itself onto my soul. Yeah.
Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the writing process, because you have a unique perspective on what writers do and how they approach their work. Mm-hmm. They're kind of explorers.
Yes. Okay. So we talk a lot about plotters and pantsers. I believe there are mappers and explorers. There are people that like to have, you know, a set out roadmap. They want to know where they're going. They're going to stop at the world's greatest, biggest ball of yarn. They're going to do, they're going to visit X, Y, and Z battlefield on the road, right? They know what they want to do. And there are people who hit, you know, they throw some water in a cooler and just jump in the car and go where the wind takes them. And I don't think there's any right or wrong way to write a book. For me, I become more of a mapper as time goes on because there, you know, I try to get more complex in my stories as, you know, I develop as an author. I'm kind of like practicing law or practicing medicine. I'm practicing at writing because I want to evolve and become better with each book. And so I feel like if I have more of a roadmap for me, that it really helps me to make sure that I am not missing any vital turns along the way. That said, there is the joy of organic exploration, and that happens no matter how hard I try to avoid it. A classic example would be in my prior book, The School for German Brides. There was a character that leapt out in chapter 4, Clara. I had no plans to write this friend who would unite the two timelines, even though she was so vital. She was so vital to the plot, and she became like possibly the most interesting character in the whole book in retrospect. And she came out of nowhere, and I loved writing her. And honestly, she probably should have been a POV character, but she just decided to weasel her way into my pages and into my heart. And I loved that. So I love that there is room for both in the process. And that has been one of the great joys of being an author. Yeah.
You've written that you think the key ingredient to being successful as a writer is resiliency. Can
yes.
you expand on that?
It is about getting knocked down 10 times and standing up 11. It sounds trite, but it's absolutely true. It doesn't matter what phase of your career you're in. You will face rejection, whether, you know, if you're starting out, you're going to get rejected by any number of agents. Even if you write the next, if you write the next Outlander, I mean, it took her a while to get off the ground because they didn't know where to shelve it because it was so different and so unique and so wonderful. And I have a huge respect for Diana. She's amazing. So you're going to face rejection. Every author has rejection stories, but even as you think, oh, once I get an agent, I've made it. Once I get a book deal, I've made it. Once I get, you know, a multi-book contract, I've made it. And the truth is, the bar keeps raising and raising and raising. And you're going to face disappointment. This path to success is never linear. You are on top for one book and down for the next. And sometimes you have to make some big changes. Sometimes, you know, if sales don't peter out and your house isn't willing to commit to signing another book, you have to make the decision. Am I going to sit tight and wait and see if they're going to offer me one? Maybe the advance will be lower. Or am I going to look to another house? You know, and it's, you know, you have to face some really tough decisions. And it's, and sometimes you might have to pivot away from a genre that you love. Sometimes you have to diversify. I, you know, things are going pretty darn well for me. I mean, look at this beautiful audience. You guys are amazing. And you came out to see me. This is great. And, but the truth of the matter is, like, you know, even I feel the need to diversify. You know, because who knows what could happen tomorrow? And I mean, especially in historical fiction, the World War II bubble kind of burst, which was fine. I was ready to pivot away anyway. But you have to be prepared to pivot on a dime. So I'm expanding into contemporary women's fiction, not to replace my historical stuff, but as a supplement, in order to, you know, broaden my readership and hopefully bring some people into my historical fiction and, you know, and vice versa. And to expand my historical readers and show them some fun contemporary stuff that might actually be their catnip that might not otherwise have been.
Wow, I have to go back to something you just said because I didn't get the memo that the World War II bubble burst.
Well, it has and it hasn't. I feel like it's harder. Like if you were, you know, if you're Pam Jenoff or Kristen Harmel or, you know, any number of people who are established. I mean, Pam Jenoff, that's her brand, writing love letters to World War II, you know, Europe and to her and to the Jewish people who survived World War II. That is what her brand is. She will always be able to write that, I'm guessing, as long as she wants to. But I think that for newer authors or people who haven't really sunk their nails into, they're kind of being encouraged to maybe try something different. And I do feel kind of like it's the Wild Wild West right now in historical fiction because nobody knows what the next big thing is. Because for a long time, it was the Tudors, which is great. I loved it. You know, I'm a big Philippa Gregory fan, a big Alison Weir fan. And I love that stuff. But then it was World War II and 20th century stuff. And we don't know what's next. Maybe it'll be 1870. Maybe. That'd be great. But, you know, and I love that it changes. And it's a challenge. And you just have to be willing to pivot. And I, for one, you know, there are people like Philippa Gregory. She's a prime example who are literally scholars in their timeline. And they have so much research. You could say, I want you to write sister, whatever, you know, like her sister, cousin-in-law, what have you. And she could do it. She probably has a dozen books on her shelves with references to said obscure Tudor character. I like to be more of a Jane of all trades and to be able to move and to research new things and to go a little bit more where the wind blows me as far as eras and topics.
That's great. Let's now pivot and talk about Amy as a reader, because you've mentioned some of the books that you've loved that have influenced you. What have you read recently this summer that you would say, if you like my books, read these?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question. So, I to be really honest, this summer I've been traveling so much, it's been really, really hard to read. After Anne by Logan Steiner is brilliant. That's one that isn't out, but Denny Bryce, The Other Princess, put that on your TBR list. It's coming out sometime this fall, I believe.
The one about Victoria.
Yeah, Victoria's goddaughter. Yes, her goddaughter from Sierra Leone. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant, starring Adele Astaire by Eliza Knight is lovely. And we've got The Phoenix Crown by Kate Quinn and Janie Chang that's coming out. That is a collaboration. If you like collaborative novels, it doesn't get better than Kate and Janie. They're fabulous. And my co-author Janelle Siselski has a duology. The second one just came out last week. The first one was The Brilliance of Stars, and the second was To Free the Stars. And it's kind of a Winter Soldier retelling, but it's more romantic, and it's kind of a nod to that Marvel series, but in a way that doesn't feel like in the Marvel universe, but it's really touching, and it deals with, you know, some PTSD issues and really just a unique and brilliant love story. She does quirky heroines like nobody else. So Jack and Ivy, lots of love for Jack and Ivy.
One of the other things I've discovered about you is you are not just a reader, you encourage readers and those around you, but sometimes that's a challenge. And I know that there are people who come into the bookstores and say, I love to read, but my wife is not a reader, or I'm a big reader, but my kids don't read. You've had some experience with that. Can you kind of share that?
Yes. Both of my children are dyslexic. Now, so when I first found out I was expecting my son, I went out and bought like $200 worth of books in French. Like, I was going to teach them French. I have a master's in French. And I got Le Petit Nicolas and Le Petit Prince and Madeleine, all the classics. And they have a French library. And I was going to teach them French and we were going to learn to read. And it was going to be amazing. It was going to be amazing. And, you know, we would spend long hours baking in the kitchen and we would read stories. They would get lost in Middle Earth and Narnia. And it was just going to be, you know, they'd have this beautiful multicolored library and it would be, you know, the word nerd's haven, right? And I was given two children who are dyslexic, and my son, like severely so. And it was a challenge because it does kind of feel like I'm being rebuffed as a human being, because it's like the center. I was reading when I was three. You know, I was a precocious little nerd, and it was hard at first to relate to that. Like, I don't know how to help you. Not just like a personal rebuff, but I don't know how to help you because I can't, you know, I can't visualize this. And I had to get past that. And my kids, I read for about 2 hours because I came up from Tucson tonight. I read for my kids for about 2 hours from a Percy Jackson novel, and they're enthralled. And they could answer all kinds of questions that, you know, all about the Greek gods, this, that, and the other thing. They love it. And it really, when I got away, and the fact that the main character is dyslexic, epic. And I kind of divorced myself from the idea that reading meant the printed word. I'm a huge audiobook fan because, you know, it's hard sometimes to have the time to sit down and read because the average book of this length takes about 8 to 10 hours to read, right? And, you know, if you've got 15-minute chunks, it's easy to forget what you already read. And I find that, you know, if I've got 10 minutes to drive to pick my kids up or do X, Y, and Z, the audiobooks are a great way to fill that gap and to still kind of immerse myself in story. And it helps with folding laundry and doing chores. It's wonderful, right? And it's harder to read while you're doing that. And so that's what I did. You know, I was homeschooling my kids as a newly single mom during the pandemic. And not that we're out of it, obviously. But, you know, during the period where they were not welcome in school. And that's when I really realized that we were focusing or that we were dealing with a problem. And so, you know, yeah, we sat down and struggled over the printed pages, but we found other ways to discuss story, you know, through audiobooks and then me reading aloud.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.